Montana talks here. Live and local. This is Montana Talks with Aaron Flint. Broadcasting live across the great state of Montana, powered by the Montana Electric Cooperative Association. Your Montana Electric Cooperative, they do much more than keep the lights on for you. This is Montana Talks with Aaron Flint.
It's the Sam Plan. We were joking about this with John Jackson, the Joker from X on Tuesday's show. What do they mean by the Sam Plan? Is it like Sam as in Samuel? Are they talking about a dude? Is it Sam as in Samantha? Are they talking about, or is the party that can't tell us what a woman is just deliberately being ambiguous here? No, apparently their Sam Plan, the Democrats are spending $27 million on the Sam Plan to speak with American men. They want to speak with young American men. For those of you that missed it, Laura Ingraham had a hilarious montage on her program on Fox last night where she points out that, you know, even CNN thinks this is a stupid idea. They're spending a good chunk of this $27 million to target young men by buying advertisements on video games.
All I will say is, duh.
Yeah, I know. Look, they should have probably recognized this a couple of cycles before when this trend was growing very apparent. Because right now, the Democratic message is really all over the place.
You think? Well, the voters see all this. President Trump has remade the political landscape. He's the one representing the working class, making major gains with voters who earn less than $100,000 a year. And in an effort to win those people back, Democrats believe they can reinvent themselves.
Yeah, I don't think nationally the Democratic brand helps very much anyway. I mean, anywhere.
The Democrats have forgot that maybe we should just talk to people like people.
The party takes positions on issues that are weak and woke. It will seem weak and woke.
Yeah, so the party that has pushed the radical transgender agenda, the party that has told young white men in particular that you are fundamentally racist because of the color of your skin and that your country is a fundamentally racist country, that same party now wants to spend $27 million to try to figure out how to speak with American men. The same party that told them to shut up and wear their masks and, oh, nope, sorry, you're not going to get to watch a football game this year. That same party thinks that buying some ads on a video game is going to be able to help out. Charlie Kirk, Turning Point USA, has been, you know, active on both the University of Montana and the Montana State University campuses. He had this to say on Laura's program about the Sam Plan.
It feels like they're National Geographic reporters, like going into a tribe they've never come in contact with. Yeah. Like, we must investigate half the population and why they hate us so much. We speak to a lot of people on campuses, and men have been gravitating to our message, especially working class men. And it's amazing to see how President Trump didn't just win this last election, but he's remade the political map permanently.
Yeah, especially with young people. And I think young people that are focused on freedom and they envision, as we approach America's 250th birthday next year, that she will continue to be the republic, the free republic that she's supposed to be. All right, we've got callers on the phone lines coming up right after this. Stand by.
My name is
Montana Talks, uniting the Treasure State, one conversation at a time. Here's your host, Aaron Flint.
All right, coming up later in the hour, Ryan Newman is the area manager with the Bureau of Reclamation. Looking forward to catching up with him, talking about the lifeline of the High Line, the St. Mary's Irrigation Project, what the water levels are looking like, what the irrigation outlook is looking like here as we head into the summer season, especially after, you know, this headline from last summer, after we had a catastrophic breach of the St. Mary Canal siphon. And so how is the construction going? But in the meantime, what are farmers having to do to make some tough decisions until that project is back up and running? So looking forward to catching up with him here in just a few minutes. First up on the phone lines, it's great to hear from Flathead County Commissioner Pam Holmquist. Commissioner Holmquist, great to have you on the show. Thanks for calling in.
Hey, thanks a lot.
Yeah.
Appreciate it.
So we've been, I don't know if we've been talking too much about property taxes or not, but, you know, because I, you know, people are still a little, you know, a little hangry from the legislative session. But, you know, when it comes to property tax relief, who's going to see it? Who may not get relief? Who might see an increase? How much of an increase, et cetera? What do you think is important to point out from the county level? And I would say, by the way, when it comes to Flathead County, with the county commissioners that are in Flathead County, you guys have worked to mitigate and to keep property tax increases very low, despite massive increases in property appraisals. Not the case in places like Missoula and elsewhere, where they are more than happy to stick their taxpayers with higher property tax bills.
Absolutely. You know, thanks for this opportunity, because I'm still getting phone calls too from people. And basically, I think a lot of people still don't understand the process. And I just want to go over that a little bit today, because, and kind of dispel the narrative that local government does the out of control spending to a point. So of course, as we all know, the Department of Revenue starts off with the assessed value. They apply a formula. They give us half the rate of inflation from the last 3 years, the money we had from the year before, and then our new growth is all calculated into what, to the value of a mill. And it's, a mill can be valued differently in different counties. Like in Flathead County, a mill could be $200,000. In Malta, it might be $200 value. And, of course, then the Department of Revenue says, okay, Flathead County, you can mill, I'm just throwing numbers out here, 20 mills, right? And so then Flathead County kind of takes over, or the county's local government takes over, and they kind of say, okay, well, We can live with 19 mills this year. Or, yeah, we got to go to the full max 20 mills. What happens is in some of these counties, and I know Missoula has been mentioned a lot, and I would agree with that sentiment. In Missoula, you actually have an electorate there that wants more government.
They vote for all the levies. They vote for all the tax hikes.
Absolutely.
Yeah, the mob rules. Majority wants to take money out of your pocket. The majority gets to take the money out of your pocket, and that's why they keep raising property taxes there. Yeah,
and that's exactly what happens in some of the counties. You know, in Flathead County, we say no to a lot of that, because the majority of our folks in Flathead County want less government, and I agree with that sentiment totally. So frankly, the legislature did an amazing job of trying to work this all out. And I got to give kudos to a lot of the representatives and senators and all of them that tried really hard. But at the end of the day, if you have an electorate in a county such as Missoula who wants all that, and they keep reelecting the same people, the legislature can't fix that.
That's right. That's right. Now, we, the people, could pass an initiative that would, you know, stop basing property taxes based off of property values, and that could help address it. But I know that would create some challenges at the local level for how, you know, then how you would, you know, go over budgets and everything like that. But,
you know, being really involved here in the last year and a half in a lot of this, and getting to know it even better on the state side, I think what we really should have looked at more when in PTAC, when I was on that committee, is possibly how we assess things, and maybe the cycle on how we assess things, and maybe have some sort of a trigger, not really on the homestead concept thing, but how long a person has owned their property. You know, maybe you got to look at the assessed side, not the rate side, you know, the rate of the taxes.
You know, when you look at when you look at the big picture of the property tax relief that came out of the legislature, a very clear residential property tax payers should get relief, should get significant relief. You made a great point. Somebody was asking, well, hey, I rent out my second home to my daughter. Am I going to get hit with a massive tax hike there? And you called in and, or sent us a message and said, hey, long-term rentals will also see property tax relief. So that's good there. It's the Airbnbs, the VRBOs, and then the people that own second homes here straight up. They're going to get hit with a pretty big increase. What about agriculture? I've heard conflicting. Some people say ag's going to take a big hit. Some people say it's going to be a smaller hit. And then some of us say, well, why would they take a hit at all?
Right. Well, there is it's homestead, comstead, and it's also small ag. So depending on your receipts, I'm not exactly sure what formula they're going to use. I think they're still trying to figure that out. But small ag isn't supposed to be hit as hard or at all. But large ag is supposed to get a hit. And right now, God only knows what that's going to look like. I mean, they're talking about some of these second homes getting a 60% increase in their taxes, which is frankly outrageous. I mean, there's a lot of folks in Gladys County that bought, you know, their parents bought a lake home somewhere on Ashley or somewhere, and now that's considered, you know, this second home.
Yeah, and you might lose the family cabin. Yeah, it's crazy. All right, hold that thought, Commissioner Holmquist. We'll come back to you right after this.
Securing America.
A recent Senate Appropriations Subcommittee hearing focused on the fiscal year 2026 budget for the National Guard and Reserves. The chief of the National Guard Bureau, General Stephen Nordhaus, described the economics of the military's citizens branch.
We represent 20% of the joint force at 4% of the budget.
Which leaders reminded senators makes the Guard and Reserves vital. Lieutenant General Leonard Anderson is the commander of the Marine Corps Reserve.
It's not just a funding line. It's a warfighting requirement.
However, the witnesses, such as Lieutenant General Robert Harder, the chief of the Army Reserve, testified that despite that principle, they don't have what they need to operate properly.
With our largest problem areas being inadequate manning in our formations, aging facilities that don't support our training requirements, and poor equipment readiness.
Witnesses from the other military branches testified to similar problems. Kevin Uretsky, Fox News.
Broadcasting live across the big sky, Montana Talks with Aaron Flint.
All right, yeah, coming up here in just a few minutes, we're going to catch up with the area manager for the Bureau of Reclamation, the Federal Bureau of Reclamation, talking about the lifeline of the High Line and High Line water. What's the High Line water situation looking like here heading into the summer? By the way, I've heard that progress, that construction on the St. Mary siphon is just going very well with the construction crews up there, but we'll chat with the BOR about that. But the question is, what do, you know, farmers, ranchers, and folks who rely on that water project for their clean drinking water, what do they do in the meantime until that siphon is back up and running? I know, especially since we're in a, you know, tough water situation on parts of the High Line heading into the summer, it seems like south central and southwestern Montana, especially south central Montana and the Beartooth, have soaked up most of the moisture here this year with the snow and then some of the recent rains as well. But first, let's go back to Flathead County Commissioner Pam Holmquist. Pam, you know, I was looking, I first shared some of these population statistics back in April. Our friend Dan Stusick, who's on the Legislative Redistricting Commission, you know, pays close attention to these numbers, obviously. But Flathead County had the largest number increase in the whole state for population growth between 2020 and 2024. Let me just share a couple of numbers out of here. Yeah, in the last release of census data, liberal news service called the Daily Montanan had a bigger write-up here. Gallatin and Flathead counties added 1,055 and 1,032 new residents, respectively, the first time since the population boom began in 2020 that Flathead County has not led in raw numbers, but the growth rate is higher in Flathead. Let's see. Since 2020, Flathead County has led the state in sheer number of additional residents, adding more than 10,100 to Gallatin's just over 8,000 and Yellowstone County's 6,800. You know, as I was reading these numbers, and especially seeing the growth in Kalispell in particular, where I think Kalispell's had a nearly 25% increase in population from 2020 to 24, I think about the fact that agriculture land might see a property tax increase as a result of this legislation. Cal, you're already losing farm ground. How much more farm ground could you potentially lose with property taxes?
Yeah, you know, we're definitely been growing way too fast. As a third generation Pettit County person here, it's just really sad to see some of the farmland being put into subdivisions. But you know, at the end of the day, it becomes a property right, and some of these smaller farms, I worry more about them than the larger ones, because they're being turned into developments because they can't make a living off the land anymore. The parents have passed and the kids are trying to make it work, and it's just not working. So yeah, the growth here has been crazy, which creates a lot of issues for government. Kalispell has seen an immense amount of growth, but they've got a lot of development going on. They saw it kind of coming early on, and they extended their mains for their sewer out on the west side of town. And if you drive out there now, it's just all of that, most of that land out there is just full of apartments and condos and just a lot of density. I don't like seeing it being born and raised here, but I don't know how you stop it. It's just what it is.
Well, and people are seeking freedom in Flathead County, you know, not just beautiful views, but, you know, people are more freedom-oriented in the Flathead Valley. That's why so many of our fellow military veterans settle there as well after leaving the service. And I just wish we never lost my grandparents' house there between Summers and Lakeside back in the early 1990s. But, you know, you don't have the cash, what do you do? But then now, what even if you did have the cash, could you afford the property taxes on it if you were even able to keep it?
Yeah, you have a lot of people here, a lot of people looking for houses, so the rent goes up, you know, and it's just, right now, I've been talking to some realtors and economists here, and they're saying that actually rent's starting to come down finally a little bit because of all the property and condos that have come online or apartments. So actually, we're starting to kind of turn a corner, but I don't know, it's going to take a long time to absorb all this growth.
Yeah. What else did you want to say just about the property tax bills that came out of the legislature? SB 117, well, I know, was something you wanted to talk about in particular. Is that the bill where they basically, any new growth, that the tax revenue from that would be applied to the current budget situation, something to that effect?
Yeah, what it did is it took away our cap, our 15-10-420, which I've talked about a lot. That cap held us a half of the rate of inflation from the last 3 years. So it took that away and just came up with frankly, an arbitrary number that we can assess from 4 to 4.75%. That originally started out that they were only going to give us 50% of our growth on top of that, which would have cost Flathead County over $600,000 in our general fund. So we fought that, MACO fought that, and we actually got it up that we're going to get 75% of our growth, which should be okay, because if we can go to 4 to 4.75 on the other side, that should take care of that 25% of growth that we're not going to get. Mainly because if you look over a 10-year period under the half of the rate of inflation cap, we were at 3.9%. Averaged out over 10 years. So we should be fairly close in there. But it's a concern, because until something is implemented, it's just really a guessing game on how it's going to end up.
Well, and it sounds like we've got more time to figure this out. The Department of Revenue, I mean, there's so many changes that were made that the Department of Revenue's got some work on their hands to figure all of this out. And in the short term, we should all benefit from that $400 rebate at least this year, right?
Exactly. Yeah. On the 117, they're not going to apply that this year. They just cannot get it done. And then the other part is the property tax. Yes, a lot of that is not going to be implemented, the rate shifts and all that, because they just can't get it done. It's just too late. So
All right. Well, Commissioner Holmquist, we appreciate your phone call. Thanks for jumping in on the conversation.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Yeah, I know that. I mean, I would just say it again, you know, so much of what happens, I mean, she pointed it out, people, you know, people vote for these property tax increases, different levies and things like that. And unfortunately, it's been mob rule. You live in Missoula, and if the majority says they're going to take money out of your pocket, well, mob rule. The majority says they're going to take money out of your pocket. And that's why, you know, the city and the county in Missoula collectively with Democrat city council, Democrat county commissioners, and a very liberal voting base. That's why one of the things I wish the legislature would have gotten done is requiring a supermajority before they can force a tax increase on you. That to me would prevent mob rule, and you would need to have a broader public support before they come in and raise your property taxes. All right. Great to hear from Commissioner Holmquist, you know, talking about farmland in the Flathead Valley. Well, now let's talk about farmland all across Montana's High Line, all across Highway 2, you know, Highway 2, which of course stretches from there in the Flathead Valley all the way across to the North Dakota border. It's great to have Ryan Newman with us, back with us. He's the area manager with the Bureau of Reclamation. Ryan, thanks for being with us.
You betcha. Glad to be here. Good morning.
Yeah, good to see you. Well, where do we start?
Well, I guess maybe we can just give a real quick update. When we were in here last time, we were talking about the failure that happened last year, June 17th, about 8 in the morning or so, the St. Mary siphon failed. It was a catastrophic event that we're all very fully aware of. Since that time, a lot has happened, an incredible amount has happened. And, you know, folks really mobilized on the ground, Milk River Joint Border Control, Bureau of Reclamation, Blackfeet Tribe, Montana's delegation, locals up there, to really get a project stood up and rolling and hit the ground running.
I remember a year ago, like, seeing some of the photos you guys shared with us, and it looked like a rusted out tailpipe on the back of a 1970s Pinto. I mean, this, you know, but that's how old this infrastructure was. And I know you guys have been screaming about it. Farmers and ranchers here in Montana have been screaming about it for, you know, almost over two decades now. But sometimes it takes a crisis before something finally gets fixed.
Yeah, that's exactly right. It was very old. You know, as we mentioned before, the two pipes, the two siphons, one was built in the 19-teens, the other one was mid-20s, so very, very old. I like your analogy, it's spot on. And to underscore how the outcry went for years and years, you know, the St. Mary Working Group, they spent a lot of time up there really pounding drums and, hey, folks, we have a serious issue. We have a big challenge here, and it needs to be replaced now. And that was 20 years ago.
You know, there was some concern earlier in the year as the DOGE cuts were going into effect, and DOGE was identifying fraud, waste, and abuse across the government. Some people were concerned that that was going to impact funding for this project, but Senator Steve Daines came in and said, no, this project is on track, the funding is on track, and the construction progress bears that out. As I was seeing all these DOGE cuts and the wasteful spending at USAID, sex change surgeries in other countries, I was like, wow, that could have paid for St. Mary's. Oh, that could have paid for St. Mary's. It was like all this money going all over the world that could have paid for 100 of these different types of projects. But nonetheless, it does look like the construction's going very well. What's that tall structure that they're building at the construction site?
Yeah, that's the inlet structure and the outlet. That's where the canal transitions into the siphons, sets up the hydraulic controls to facilitate that water moving through the pipe itself. And then the other very large concrete structure on the outlet side, which would be the east side, downstream side, is what essentially captures that water and, again, hydrologically facilitates that water moving into the canal.
Yeah, it reminds me of the powerhouses at the Fort Peck Dam, because, of course, I love the powerhouses at the Fort Peck Dam. It's, you know, that's like skyscrapers in northeast Montana when you grew up there as a kid. And then my grandpa had some great photos that he took over the years. But, yeah, it reminds me of that type of a structure so that's being built. All right, well, we're going to talk timelines. When do you expect the whole project to be completed by? And what do farmers, ranchers, recreationalists, and others do in the meantime? We'll talk about that and more with Ryan Newman from the Bureau of Reclamation right after this. And hey, if you want to jump in on the conversation, I know we got folks listening all across the High Line. Give us a call right now. Jump in on the conversation, 406-294-0970, or message us on the Montana Talks app.
This is where Montana Talks app with Lane Nordland.
USDA's latest Cattle on Feed report is out. USDA livestock analyst Michael McConnell breaks down the numbers.
We have relatively smaller inventories and feedlots relative to a year ago, with fewer placements and fewer markings. That's reflective of the overall tighter cattle situation than what we've seen the past couple of years. Feedlots with over 1,000 head, there was 11.38 million head of cattle in those feedlots, which is 2% lower than a year ago. Over the course of the month of April, placements were 1.631 million head. That's 3% lower than a year ago.
He added that strong fed cattle placements were seen as late as March of this year.
Some of that really just comes down to some seasonal factors or weather, particularly when comparing to a year ago, we had relatively light placements in March of 2024. And so sometimes you gotta be careful when you look at these numbers year over year and keep in mind what was going on the previous year. Placements have been trending lower for most of the months in 2025. Again, not just reflective primarily of the fact that we do have and have had pretty tight cattle and cow inventories the past couple of years. Markings were 1.83 million head, which was also 3% lower than a year ago.
Strong fed steer prices are also limiting marketings as of the May 1st report.
And supportive wholesale beef prices as well. So even though we have relatively tight inventories of cattle, we're still seeing some pretty strong demand for beef, which is supporting the prices of both fed steer and wholesale beef prices as well.
Demand is expected to maintain its pace as the summer grilling season picks up. I'm Lane Northland.
Montana Talks with Aaron Flint.
Hey, let's sneak in a quick phone call here as we chat with the area manager for the Federal Bureau of Reclamation. We got Mike in Bozeman on the phone lines listening to 1450 KMMS. Mike, did you have a quick question or comment? Great to hear from you.
Well, Aaron, appreciate it. Back in 86, I believe I worked on the pipes you're talking about. It took us 3 months. We were sandblasting the inside of both of those tubes, and then we put coal tar in it. We started in September, and we got done around the 1st of December. And I spent the day inside that pipe from dawn till dusk, every day sandblasting. And it was quite a project, but I was amazed at what a brilliant idea it was to siphon that water across the valley to get it to the next chunk of canal. And so I guess that was probably the last time they had some serious maintenance done on them. And so that was 86. So
interesting. Yeah, so and especially when you think about it, all this stuff, when it was originally first put in, was practically built by hand. I know, Ryan Newman, you were telling us about that the last time you joined us on the show. So, you know, I'm going to play the caveman lawyer routine. You know, I'm just a caveman. I don't know all these crazy lawyer games. So I'm not an engineer either. So from an engineering standpoint, I guess talk about what Mike would have seen in 1986 and how different the engineering is today. And then by the numbers, just how big of a project this truly is.
Yeah, well, first off, I mean, steel, right? But we've come a long ways in the steel industry and how pipe is put together, rolled out, connected, cathodic protection, how that's put in place and implemented. So it's come a long ways since then. And just back to what Mike was saying, you know, people look at this infrastructure and see how old it is and say, hey, how come it hasn't been replaced yet? But the fact that it's still up and operational up through 2024 is a testament to the workmanship, to craftsmanship, not only when it was originally constructed, but all the folks like your last caller who put a lot of work and effort and time into maintaining it. So its longevity is a testament to the skilled labor and, you know, maintenance that's gone on over the years, because it has received a lot of maintenance.
It's received a lot of maintenance, but what it really needed was a big overhaul that it's now finally getting in that part. But there's a lot more that also needs to be done kind of all across the High Line as well.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, right now this St. Mary siphon that we're replacing, we also still need to replace Hulse Cooley. That's another large siphon, and they're each in equal shape, equal states of degradation, you could say. And that's just down canal a few miles. And so right now, you know, you talked about dollars. It's about a $70 million project total for the two siphons to be replaced. Once we get this one done, we're going to be starting on Hulse Cooley as soon as possibly next week, even, you know, getting the road cut in and getting ready to start doing the actual work on that replacement, hoping to have that thing done hopefully by December of this year, knock on wood.
Yeah.
And so those are two huge structures to replace.
Speaking of timelines, when do you expect this St. Mary's siphon to be fully up and running, fully complete? Because I know last summer when we caught up with you, you were thinking, you know, they were hopeful by the, you know, before the end of the summer, or, you know, maybe it may not be till the fall. What are they looking like right now?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked that. You know, with the work starting last year, right now we're looking at being done basically the last week of June, which is huge.
Really? I mean,
okay. It failed June 17th. It would be pretty cool to have it done by June 17th. It's going to be tough. It's probably going to be later on in June, a couple weeks after that.
So that sounds like very good news.
And then the water will be moving.
I was not expecting June. I was barely hoping for July or something, especially given the water outlook right now. I know hearing from guys like Marco Manukian and others up there in Phillips County, I mean, you know, it's been very dry, looking at a drought situation. And so, and, you know, you had irrigation that could help you through those dry periods. And so, I guess, talk about what you're hearing from those farmers and those irrigators here in the meantime. And now it sounds like that gap is going to be shorter than what we initially anticipated, but still it's a gap nonetheless. And that's a lot of money that we're losing out on, a lot of farmland we're losing out on in the meantime.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And just, you know, the St. Mary Canal, that water moves over up to 80% of the annual water budget comes from the St. Mary system on dry years, and this is going to be a year like that. You know, right now we have, it's very dry up there. It's trending dry right now. It's dry outlook for the summer. There was a little bit good, decent pulse of moisture early on. We're able to capitalize on that in the lower basin a little bit in storage in Nelson. But yeah, we were anticipating possibly having no irrigation season this year, but we started releasing water on May 20th. And about the second week of June is when those irrigation deliveries are going to see. So a very, very truncated irrigation season this year, but some water nonetheless, better than zero, which we were actually anticipating starting last year. So that's good news.
Yeah. Let's see. I was also, you know, I know what I was thinking. So I heard from one of our friends in Malta yesterday, and he said, you know, over the Memorial Day weekend, even though the water is low and even though the wind can still get pretty windy, he said that doesn't deter the fishermen. They were still out on Nelson Reservoir. So people are still able, you know, they're still getting out there even though water is low and things like that.
Yeah, absolutely. And Nelson, the water is a little bit higher because we were able to capitalize on some of the early runoff and capture that in the Dodson South Canal and get moved into those reservoirs. But yeah, recreationalists love to recreate no matter what. And anything we can do to, you know, help support that, we do.
By the numbers, what are some of the numbers that kind of stand out to you in terms of just how much water this feeds out there? You've got 18,000, I was looking at a Montana Free Press article here by Tom Ludi. More than 18,000 Montanans rely on the irrigation project for drinking water. 140,000 acres of irrigated farmland along its canals. Farmers lost half the water necessary to make it through 2024 and face a similar rationing challenge this summer that will leave tens of thousands of acres dry much of this season. Any other numbers that stand out to you in particular?
Well, no, those are essentially it. Those are essentially it. And it's like we always call it, the lifeline or the high line. I tell you what, you can't coin a better and more accurate term with, you know, 18,000 plus people relying on that for their drinking water. And, you know, the irrigation land up there across that area, it's significant. One number I will call out is 1 year from failure to water running. So that will be significant to see water running through the siphon, you know, at the very end of June, and that'll be a major accomplishment. So if I had to call out a number, it'd be one.
I was going to say, because after chatting with you last summer and then just knowing how the federal government typically operates, and not you guys, but higher levels, I was like, man, we'll be lucky if this thing's even done before the end of the summer. What got it done within that one-year time frame, would you say?
It's a multitude of things. First and foremost, our partners, the state of Montana, Milk River Joint Board of Control, Blackfeet Tribe, you know, Montana's delegation, everyone really came together, rallied around this, and got the job done. We were able to convey O&M of the structure over to the Milk River Joint Board of Control, and they were able to execute the contract. They got some amazing contractors that are doing the work for them, and they're just absolutely knocking it out of the park. It's really fun to watch. And it's really a local effort, and everyone just getting her done. And
did they
done
speed
fast.
Things up at the federal level, or was it just that nobody got in the way, nobody dragged their feet, everybody just had their game on point?
Well, Reclamation, we were able to do a couple things very rapidly, a couple processes. I won't go into detail for sake of time, but essentially items that would take 6-7 months, we were able to get done in 2 weeks.
Wow.
And able to get some designations that changed that cost allocation between us and the non-federal entity, and that really helped move this project forward in a fast way as well.
I'm trying to think of a way to throw you a political question without throwing you a political question because I know you're a seasoned professional and you guys stay away from politics, but an administration can either make things harder or make things easier, so we don't know what could have been or what could not have been, but is it safe to at least say that the current administration was at least helping the process along?
You know, we've been fortunate as an agency. We manage water and power, and it's a pretty nonpartisan thing. People like their water, people need their power, and so really it becomes our responsibility to tell our story and to show what it is we need to do, why it matters, how it hits the ground, how it benefits all Americans and taxpayers. And so the onus really lands on us to communicate upward, and we have, you know, great support in the administration. We always do. Just have to tell the story and what it is and why it is, and like I said, enough can't be said for Montana's delegation, who really came out and helped a lot to move things along as well. And Milk River Joint Board Control has been awesome.
The budget, this was crazy. So I was talking with Ryan Newman during the last break, because, you know, before we went into the last break, I was saying how, you know, all this foreign aid that was going to all these crazy things and all these crazy places, and I would just sit here on the show and do the math, and I'd be like, that would have paid for St. Mary's, that would have paid for St. Mary's. Ryan, you were telling me the BOR's entire budget is what, $1.3 billion?
Yeah, roughly. Yeah, there's some, you know, pass through money, some write-ins here and there that bump different projects up around the country, but by and large, we're about a $1.3 billion base cost agency
for all of this American infrastructure, that, yep, the, you know, the backbone of our economy. So I just saw the Florida Attorney General the other day. You know, there's all these battles in the news right now, Trump v. Harvard, and Harvard has like 30% of their students are foreign students. The Florida Attorney General said that we are subsidizing foreign students to get educated in the United States to the tune of $2 billion a year. We're spending more on foreign students' education than we are on the BOR budget. It's crazy. Dream.
Broadcasting live across the great state of Montana, powered by the Montana Electric Cooperative Association. Your Montana Electric Cooperative, they do much more than keep the lights on for you. This is Montana Talks with Aaron Flint.
Yeah, by the way, I know the Bureau of Reclamation has definitely mentioned the companies, the Montana companies that are doing incredible work on this St. Mary's project, Sletten, Northwest Construction, and HDR. So Sletten and Northwest Construction in particular, HDR, some Montana companies doing some great work on some Montana infrastructure here, working with and through the Bureau of Reclamation. Ryan Newman is the area manager. You know, I was going to, you know, say thanks and then open up the phone lines. Hey, if people do want to call in and talk to Ryan Newman, give us a call right now, and I should be able to get to you before we run out of time. But I thought, hey, let's keep this going here as well. You mentioned how, you know, a great point, how water and power shouldn't be political and really never used to be political. It was just something everybody just got on board to make happen, right? Power certainly started to get very political. Silicon Valley was demanding this kind of power, this color power, that kind of power. But now everybody is so desperate for electricity and for power that Silicon Valley doesn't care where they get it from. They just need power. I had somebody message us the other day, speaking of Fort Peck, you know, I mentioned Fort Peck earlier. Obviously, that's an Army Corps of Engineers run project, but somebody messaged me and they said, if they remember right, when they had toured the powerhouses back in the day, they were told that they actually could add more generators at the Fort Peck Dam and actually generate more electricity with the existing capacity if they chose to do so. Now, I don't know if that's true or not. I can't remember that from my tour of the dam. But it got me thinking, as we have you here, the area manager for the Bureau of Reclamation, you've got a lot of your own hydropower facilities. Could more generating capacity be built within the existing structures that are out here across Montana right now?
Oh, absolutely. You know, whenever you have falling water, moving water, you got that kinetic energy, we can capture it and produce electricity. And there's quite a bit of that that exists, whether it's the Afterbay facility down at Yellowtail that we're currently with the Crow Tribe to develop, or whether it's some of the infrastructure we have in our irrigation districts, like we're working with Erling Jewell up out of GID, Greenfield Irrigation District. He's developing, you know, some smaller scale hydropower on his conveyance infrastructure. You know, Gibson Dam, there's opportunities to produce it there. Areas where we, i.e. Reclamation, have the authority to develop power, we either develop it like you see at down at Yellowtail Dam or, you know, up in central Montana, but Canyon Ferry. But also where we don't have the authority to do it, we can do what's called work with FERC and through FERC licensing, which you see up on Tiber. There's a small power facility up there. Or we can do the lease of power privilege like we do with Greenfield Irrigation District, and we take our power authority and we lease that privilege to the irrigation district. They develop it, they market it, they're beneficiaries of the revenue, and then that revenue kicks back in to help pay for these projects like we're seeing here. So that's a long answer to a short question, which is yes, there's a lot of opportunity and we need to be doing more of it.
Well, and what are you seeing and hearing about the power demand out there? We had an expert from the Competitive Enterprise Institute with us in studio just a couple of weeks ago. They were here with the Frontier Institute, and I can't remember if she said that we're projected to lose 19 gigawatts, if I remember right, in just by 2030, and yet we're projecting to need 27 more gigawatts, if I'm remembering right. So basically, we're projected to lose a lot of power, online power, that's being provided in America right now, but yet we're also projected to need a heck of a lot more. So that's kind of the perfect storm.
Yeah, you know, one of the bottlenecks in there is transmission, right? Because we can produce power, but then we need to get it to where it counts. And that's some of the challenges that we've had at some of our locations. For example, we're talking about St. Mary's Canal. There's an opportunity to develop hydropower at the drop structures at the end of the St. Mary Canal. However, that power has to make it out onto the grid. And so you can generate it, but then we need to transmit it. And that is definitely a challenge that we face in these rural remotes and rural areas like we see out here in the West. But in terms of generation potential, there's a lot. And there's additional capacity. And then as technology increases and we get better and more effective and more efficient generators that can function at different heads and different capacities, it really changes that cost benefit analysis. Well, also,
could you plunk a data center right next to that very facility? Now you've got the cipher feeding water to the farmers, and now you add a generational capability, and now you've got a data center. Now you're bringing in revenue to that local county and that local community as well on top of it.
Yeah, that's a lot of power. I'm not a power guy in terms of electrical engineering, but I can tell you those data centers take an enormous amount of power, much more than you'd see on the more micro hydro level. But hey, you know, we get into some of these predicaments, death by paper cuts. Maybe that's how we get out of them.
Yeah. Well, it's just you talk about AI, and like it or not, folks, it's happening. It's here, and it's a critical component to the, really, whether you want to call it the arms race or the energy race or the economic, whatever race you want to call it, with the communist Chinese. If we don't have the power, if we don't have the electricity, and if we don't have the AI capabilities, we're going to fall behind in a number of other categories. All right, Ryan Newman, Area Manager for the Bureau of Reclamation. Appreciate your time this morning. Thanks so much for being with us, and give a thanks to all those crews out there getting the work done. It's good to hear a little bit of good news here.
Yeah, absolutely. Awesome crews. They're doing amazing work.
All right. Anything else you want to share with our listeners? We've got about 30 seconds to go.
Again, just a shout out and a big thank you to everyone who's really helped us get this done, from the crews, the construction company, working weekends, working long days, working over the winter, very adverse weather conditions, to Milkford Joint Border Control and Blackfeet Tribe, state of Montana, help us get this thing stood up.
All right. Appreciate you being with us here. We're out of time for today. I haven't even checked the calendar for what we got coming up for you tomorrow. But, hey, you know, if all else fails, we take phone calls and more. It's always a great time here on the show where you get to talk Montana Talks.